So welcome to week two of Ripped from the Headlines. Thank you for all of those of you who returned, and to all our newcomers as well. The first thing we, of course, need to talk about is what really was in the headlines this past week, and that is, first of all, to dedicate this year Le'ilu Nishmas, those who were murdered in this past Shabbos' terrible shooting attack in Pittsburgh, as well as to offer Lirfua Shlema, those who are wounded and still recovering. I didn't feel it fit to talk about in a discussion this week. I think that most of you will understand me on that. It's still very, very raw. And really any discussion, you know, can come across as insensitive, sometimes judgmental, especially if we're looking at, you know, different aspects of it, as opposed to just offering sympathy and sorrow. I don't think that now is the time to do so. So we will, you know, not put that at the side, acknowledge it up front, and, you know, offer our, you know, most emotional sorrow over that event, but not necessarily go about giving a shiur on the various halachic topics that might be appropriate for another time to discuss, but I don't feel that that's right now. We have two major topics today. We're focusing on two stories, one which was just yesterday. There was a new study about meat eating and vegetarianism, and the second topic that we're going to discuss later is really a woman impersonating a witch and frauding someone out of a lot of money. So I'm sure those will both be very lively discussions, as well as you know, Torah that can you know, there's plenty of Torah that we can really talk about in regards to both of those topics, but even in regards to some of the specifics that we see in these articles. As we've mentioned in the past, we like to keep it as local as possible and really flesh out some of the themes that we see within. I'm not sure how much of this to read out loud. This is a very, very long article for us. I know last week we kept them kind of short, like the 681 that we have as our second article today. But we'll read pieces of it out loud, and then sort of perhaps, you know, if you want to read down and look down and read it while we're talking about it outside, that's certainly something appropriate to do. The womanization of protein consumption. Canadians quickly turning away from meat, study finds. And this was in the National Post yesterday. So according to a new survey, 6.4 million Canadians have already restricted or eliminated meat from their diets, while a third of the population intends to do so. Canadian men, more than women, consider meat one of life's greatest pleasures, and older men in particular think nothing compares to a good steak, a new survey finds. For beef farmers, that's about where the good news ends. And the article goes on to talk about a number of findings in a new study about Canadians relating to how much meat they're eating, how much they're cutting back on meat, certain properties of meat in terms of whether they are healthy or unhealthy. Also, really including dairy as well. Yeah, you can definitely take a look through it. There's a number of interviews with people who are very experienced in, you know, we have a professor from Dalhousie, and, you know, some discussion as well about where Canadians are heading in terms of becoming vegetarian or shifting more towards meat consumption. So take a look through it, you know, if anything will jump out at you. We're going to talk about two themes in particular that come up. Number one is, you know, the whole idea of people being vegetarians and moving, and society moving towards becoming more vegetarian. That's one theme that we're going to talk about, which is discussed here, that people are thinking that in the future they'll want to sort of continue towards moving more vegetarian. But we'll also talk about sort of the differences between men and women in eating meat in halacha, as is sort of discussed within this article. So take, again, a minute or so to read through the article if you can. I apologize to anybody listening to this on a recording after the fact if they don't have the text in front of them, if they're in a car somewhere. You know, dead time is always awkward on the radio. You know, you try to avoid it. So in a shiur, sometimes you know, it's also unavoidable, but if you get a chance to read the source sheet before or after, or even just the articles, this will certainly be beneficial for the rest of this year. Okay, I see a few faces looking up, so I think we can move towards more of the sources here. Anybody have their own ideas of what the Torah might think of being vegetarian in general? With any particular, let's say, sources from the beginning of Chumash. I mean, we're still at the beginning of the Torah. Relatively, we finished Bereishis, you know, Noach, Lech Lecha, Vayera, anything in there that might lean you towards thinking that one or the other is ideal or not ideal.
Well, I think that I'm pretty sure that man was only given permission to eat meat after the flood.
That is correct. We're going to talk about that. The Gemara, actually, rather than bringing the two different psukim of what man is allowed to eat at different stages, the Gemara actually brings them both and fleshes it out very clearly in source number one. Excellent. So, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda says in the name of Rav, Adam HaRishon lo hutar lo basar la'achila. Adam HaRishon was not permitted to have meat to eat. Meat was not permitted to him for consumption. Dichtiv, as it's written, Lachem ye le'achla. The beginning of that pasuk says, all the vegetation will be given to you to eat. That they have something else to eat. The Gemara actually learns it from sort of Vidrasha. It says, Lachem ye le'achla, ochol chayas ha'aretz ve'lo chayas ha'aretz. That you will be able to eat vegetation, but not the animals of the world. That is not appropriate, you know, consumption. Food is not appropriate food for you to eat. Uchshebo b'nei Noach, however, when the sons of Noach came, when the children of Noach came, hitir lahem, God allowed them and permitted them to eat meat. Shene'emar, but it says regarding meat, ki yerek esev nasati lachem et kol. Like the green herb, meaning that which was permitted prior by God to Adam HaRishon, now everything is permitted. You know, any type of animal consumption is permitted. Says the Gemara, at this point, again, we're talking about before the rules of Kashrut are laid out. This is talking about really all animals, the assumption seems to be. Yachal lo yehe ever min hachai no hegbo. And one might have thought that there's no prohibition against eating a limb from a living animal. So someone can just go over to a cow in the field and just take a bite out of it. Says the Gemara, Talmud Lomar, the Pasuk tells us, Ach basar benafsho damo lo sochelu. You cannot eat limbs of a living animal, and this applies, again, this is one of the rules, one of the seven Noahide laws that they were given at that point. Yachal ach l'shratzim, one might think that this applies even to creeping animals, that you cannot eat ever min hachai. Talmud Lomar says the Gemara, ach, it says ach basar, this does not include creepy crawly animals. So therefore, creeping animals, a non-Jew, and B'nai Noach were allowed to eat even Aver Min HaChai from them, but all animals were now permitted. So meat eating from the time of Noach and on is permitted. We'll talk about how the meat eating relates to the religion of Judaism in the next couple of sources, which is that it obviously plays an integral part of Yiddishkeit. We have korbanos, which are all about meat. We have, again, some halachos that we're going to discuss that relate to meat, but certainly meat is one of the, you know, you could almost say focal points of some of the parshios in the Torah. Which animals you may eat, which animals you may not eat. All about eating meat. How to slaughter this korban, how to slaughter this korban on this day. How to eat the korban Pesach. These are all, there are many, many rules associated with eating meat. Not all of which we'll be able to touch on. But there is something about this that seems very interesting. Rav Kook, in a publication that's called Chazon HaTzimchonut VeHashalom, which is a vision, so to say, of vegetarianism and peace. It's actually a compilation of two of his other articles that he'd written before. One was Afikim Banegev, and the other one was Tal Le'orot. They were published in various times in the early 1900s in different journals. And it's basically Rav Kook writing about vegetarianism. And his basic theory and his basic thesis is that vegetarianism, in theory, is a great thing. It's the status of Adam HaRishon Kodem HaChet. Before Adam is exiled from Gan Eden, he's told, you can only eat vegetation, you're not supposed to be eating animals. Animals are supposed to eat vegetation, you're supposed to eat vegetation, you don't eat animals. And therefore, he says that when Mashiach comes, this will be something that will be restored as an ideal of Judaism. And he has actually a number of different sources and angles that he comes at this from. We're not going to talk about how this might relate to korbanot or not, because that opens up another entire discussion about the Rambam's view on korbanos, limos hamashiach, and other things. But he does, you know, quote a number of different things that come up, and I'm just going to throw a couple of them out there. They are not... Rav Kook is mentioned by Rabbi Bleich in the next source, but his opinion is not really fleshed out as well as it could have otherwise been in terms of his positivity towards vegetarianism. He talks about Rachamav al kol ma'asav, how God has mercy on all his creatures. The Tzar Bale Chaim issue is also something that comes up, that of course we don't want to injure any animals. It is clear, though, that to eat animals, if you're not doing it in a negative, painful way, where you're intending to inflict pain on animals, there doesn't seem to be anything wrong in the Torah with slaughtering an animal for eating. That's very, very clear from the Torah. On the other hand, there are many other points that Rav Kook makes. He talks about Kisui Hadam being what he calls a biblical protest. The fact that we have to cover up the blood of the animal is sort of saying, yes, we're doing this, but we realize that it's not 100% appropriate. That's one of the things he talks about. He talks about, it's something that we need to survive for now, but once, you know, we repent for our sins properly and Mashiach comes, we won't need it for sustenance anymore. That's how he develops that. He talks about the pasuk that's going to be quoted in Rabbi Bleich's article, when it says, the Torah tells us, when you desire meat and you will say that I want meat, b'chol avad nafshecha tzachal basar, then with all the desire of your soul, may you eat meat. However, he says, you know, that's, again, speaking to sort of Dibra Torah, Keneged Yetzer Hara, so to say, what we see in some places, the Torah realizes this is what man wants and sort of gives into it, realizing that that's the reality in a sense. And therefore, he has a number of really very great constructions in sort of posing this as an ideal. However, there is, you know, one important point that sometimes gets missed, and that's the point that Rabbi Bleich makes here. I apologize if both this and the article in a little bit smaller font than I normally would use. I figured it was either that or who knows how many pages that we'd be giving you. So Rabbi Bleich says as follows. One modern-day scholar who is often cited as looking upon vegetarianism with extreme favor is the late Rabbi Abraham Isaac Kook. It is indeed the case that in his writings Rabbi Kook speaks of vegetarianism as an ideal and points to the fact that Adam did not partake of the flesh of animals. In context, however, Rabbi Kook makes those comments in his portrayal of the eschatological era. He regards man's moral state in that period as being akin to that of Adam before his sin, and does indeed view renunciation of enjoyment of animal flesh as part of the heightened moral awareness which will be manifest at that time. But Rabbi Kook is emphatic, nay, vehement, in admonishing that vegetarianism dare not be adopted as a norm of human conduct prior to the advent of the eschatological era. Rabbi Kook advances what are, in effect, four distinct arguments in renunciation of vegetarianism as a goal toward which contemporary man ought to aspire. And he lists these four arguments against adopting vegetarianism now that he says Rav Kook sort of explains. And he does, if you look in this pamphlet, Chazon HaTzimchanut VeHaShalom, you will see some very, very strong terminology and really warnings, to tell humanity to stay away from vegetarianism at this stage in time, at least as a moral goal for all of mankind to be achieving in this day and age. It's not something he feels that should be adopted, you know, by the general society now. And in fact, Rabbi Bleich in general is quite negative towards the idea of vegetarianism as a moral idea. Here's how he continues after he explains Rav Kook's sort of four reasons to reject vegetarianism as an ideal for nowadays. He says the following: despite the foregoing, vegetarianism is not rejected by Judaism as a valid lifestyle for at least some individuals. That doesn't mean if someone is a vegetarian, therefore, that they're a bad person. Because there are, to be sure, individuals who are repulsed by the prospect of consuming the flesh of a living creature. It is not the case that an individual who declines to partake of meat is ipso facto guilty of a violation of the moral code. On the contrary, and now here he quotes our pasuk, scripture states, and you will say, I will eat meat, because your soul desires to eat meat, with all the desire of your soul may you eat meat. It's really when a person wants this. Now, if a person doesn't want to eat meat, then that's okay, because, you know, the implication is that meat may be consumed when there is desire and appetite for it as food, but may be eschewed when there is no desire and, a fortiori, when it is found to be repugnant. So if someone doesn't want to eat meat, obviously for dietary reasons, we're very clear that if someone has problems eating meat physically, that's certainly not an issue. But even, he's saying, and this seems to be the clear implication of the pasuk, when someone is not interested in eating meat, there is no need to. And the question is one of perspective. Concern arises only when such conduct is elevated to the level of a moral norm. That's the way Rabbi Bleich puts it. He says, you know, we don't want to have society adopting this as it's immoral to eat animals. On the other hand, if a, you know, an individual wants to go ahead and be vegetarianism, he feels that he has the Torah's blessing, at least in this aspect. And the reason why I found this very interesting is because we, you know, the study quoted one particular part that a third of the population intends to become vegetarian in the future. And I think sort of this reminded me almost of Rav Kook's sort of ideal that we're moving towards an age where hopefully, you know, this will be some sort of moral ideal, Limos HaMashiach, when we, as a society, will move in that direction back to where Adam HaRishon was. On the other hand, you know, to know that we're not there yet, we're not in Limos HaMashiach, and we want to get there as soon as we can. And in fact, that's one of the things we'll all be talking about in this coming Shabbaton at Shari Shemayim at our Friday night Oneg. So stay tuned if you're interested in hearing more about Mashiach now, or Mashiach, waiting for Mashiach, or making Mashiach. But either which way, vegetarianism is not something that should be adopted by society, in his opinion, right now, but rather something we're looking forward to. That was one aspect of the article that really sort of resonated with me in terms of this Torah thought. But there was one other discussion that relates to the differences between men and women in consuming their meat. There is one particular halacha that is the following that we're going to talk about in source number 3. In the article, by the way, I was originally shocked by the title of the article, The Womanization of Protein Consumption. I wasn't sure if that was politically correct when they wrote that, but in fact, they're simply writing out what they found in their study here, which is that women are more likely to turn vegetarian and to have eat less meat than men do. And that's because, again, there was a great quote in here. I have to see where it was. But where was it? Here you are, almost at the bottom of the first page, about 6 lines up from the bottom of the first page. Women were more likely than men to agree meat is replaceable by other sources of protein, and men who are not overly educated were more likely to agree, I am a big fan of meat in general. Okay, let's not make any comments about people here. Eating meat is a manly thing, let's face it. It's always been portrayed as a manly thing to do, Charlebois said. Overall, the survey found that if you earn more, if you are a woman, if you are more educated, you are less likely to be attached to meat. And therefore, that's where the quote of the womanization of protein consumption came. And in fact, this is something that really is sort of shown by the statistics of this study, and is a stigma that sort of, you know, is something that people in society will comment on. Yes?
Well, you're too young, but there used to be a book called Real Men Don't Eat Quiche.
Yes.
Okay, there we go. So that was something else that sort of jumped out at me, and I said, you know, this actually comes up exactly this point in halacha. And here's the halacha. The Gemara tells us in source number 3 in Pesachim, Tanya, Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra Omer, in this price, Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra says, Bizman shebeis hamikdash kayam, ein simcha ela bevasar. At the time that the temple is standing, there is no happiness except for meat. Meaning when we're talking about festivals, shenemar v'zavachta shulamim v'achalta sham v'samachta lifnei Hashem Elokecha. And you shall sacrifice peace offerings and eat there, and you'll rejoice before the Lord your God. V'achshav she'ein beis hamikdash kayam, ein simcha ela b'yayin. And the Gemara continues, now that there's no Beis HaMikdash, for that reason, you know, we can't eat the meat of the Korbanos anymore. Now our Simcha has to come through wine, as we have a Pasuk in Tehillim, that wine gladdens the heart of man. And this is something that is really taken to a further level in terms of our Simchas Yom Tov nowadays by the Rambam, and following in his footsteps, really modern day Halacha. And the Rambam says in the following source as follows. V'chayev Adam Lios Bahen Sameach V'tov Lev. When we're talking about holidays, which is Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkot, a person needs to be very happy. Hu Uvanav V'ishto Uvnei Beiso V'chol Hanilvim Alav. Him, his sons, his daughters, his male and female servants, etc., etc. Wife, children, grandchildren, anybody that's dependent on him. As is written, V'samachtav HaKaracha Tov V'chol V'itach HaVavdecha V'amasecha. You know, so to your entire family. Afal pishi asimcha amura kan hi korban shlamim. So as we just quoted in the Gemara, the simcha that is referred to here is about the korban that we bring on the Yom Tov, the korban chagiga, which is a korban shlamim. Kemosha anu mevarin mehilchos chagiga, as we explained there. Yesh bichlal osa simcha litzmochu uvanav uvnei viso kol echad karoilo. Included in this commandment is not just partaking in the korbanos, but also being happy in general. So whatever you want to do to, you know, be happy on Yom Tov is a good thing. And how do you do that? Ketzad, continues the Rambam in the next source. What do you do to make everybody happy? Any ideas?
Cannabis.
It wasn't legal in the Rambam's day, but I'm sure he would... I was going to say, based on what the Rambam writes about drinking alcohol, I'm pretty sure he would not be so keen on the concept of cannabis, although he does mention Shosin Yayin as one of the ways to achieve Simcha for some people. But, you know, if you see what the Rambam has to say about drinking too much and the misconduct that can come from that, you know, I'm not sure he would be so supportive of cannabis on Yom Tov. But maybe that'll be the source of another shir someday. Who knows? So, haktanim, for the little kids, what do? Nosin lam klayos ve'agozim u'mikdanos. You give them, you know, little nuts. And basically, you're giving them candy, is what's going on. Whether that's candy in those days or candy in these days, that's what makes children happy. Vanashim kona lahem bigadin v'tachshitin nain kefim amono. You should buy them new clothes. V'hanashim, and what do you give to men? Ochlin basar v'shosin yayin. Shein simcha ela b'vasar v'ein simcha ela b'yayin. He quotes, in simcha ela b'vasar, that for men... What do you want to do? You get them a nice chunk of meat, a nice steak. That's what's going to make them happy. Whereas for women, it doesn't necessarily include them in the same boat. So this is another place where I sort of see the, you know, the Rambam and the way we follow halacha saying, you know, meat is for men on Yamim Tovim. Women can get other things. Children can get other things. But for the men, we give them meat and wine and they're happy and that's their Simchas Yom Tov, as started really from the korbanos of the Korban Chagiga. Now again, I am not here to resolve all of the issues that will arise from taking on vegetarianism as an ideal, nor am I advising anybody personally on what to do in either of these cases, but these are just some of the sources that we talk about. And as always, if you're planning on becoming vegetarian, just remember what's at stake.
Yes? Will Halacha have anything to say about this? The fact it says in the article here, declaration by the World Health by the WHO's Cancer Agency in 2015, that bacon, sausage, and other processed meat is a carcinogen to humans, and red meat probably too. So much the same way that I think, correct me if I'm wrong, halacha views smoking, would halacha say something about meat in that respect?
Perhaps. So this touches a little bit on what we actually talked about last week. We talked about the concept of doing dangerous actions in general. We talked about it on a more extreme scale, again, jumping into a tank full of sharks. But it is a topic in halacha that is discussed relating to things that people do much more commonly and much more often, like smoking of the days, you know, days of old, maybe 50 years ago. There is significant halachic discussion about that. It's very hard to sort of say exactly, you know, where we go with this. At what point is something really considered a concern? We mentioned last week when there's concern for the future or concern for now, there may be slight differences. Also depending on what the actual concern is, meaning what percentage of people are getting cancer and dying from eating meat or red meat. And, you know, I mean, saying that something is probably a carcinogen, just jumping out at me as someone who, you know, has a bachelor's in a science at university, doesn't sound like it's that concrete that I'm getting quite worried about it yet. You know, if in fact there are statistics, and there likely are statistics somewhere, that can really flesh out, you know, this in the meat is a carcinogen, and this is causing cancer at whatever level, that's definitely something to be concerned about. And once we get to that discussion, then there's discussions as, okay, what risks are we allowed to take just in acting as human beings? You know, if a significant amount of the population is willing to take risks, halacha allows for people to do so within a certain framework of what we call Shomer P'tayim Hashem, which is really, again, a bit of a longer discussion, but certainly there is what to talk about halachically about that aspect as well. On the other hand, you know, we do see the Torah prescribing it to us in large quantities at various times, which would seem to imply that it is permitted. And listen, perhaps it suddenly became carcinogenic between now and then. Certainly, you know, barbecuing meats, we know can, you know, that the charcoal and other, you know, heating that can happen to it can also make it, you know, not very good for people.
Not just the carcinogenic aspect, but if you have a heart history.
Yes, I was going to say, in heart, yes, that's exactly where I was going next. Heart health as well, and, you know, it's something that needs to be examined from a halakhic perspective, but also with all the exact scientific details laid out before someone can, you know, make a decision on it. My suspicion is that, you know, most poskim would follow the Shomer P'tayim Hashem, God, you know, guards the foolish, which is, again, basically permission granted to people to continue doing things that are somewhat harmful but part of daily life. That's just my personal guess. But I wonder if there's any... I believe someone mentioned a tshuva about this to me, actually. But I don't remember where it is. I'll have to look into that. And if you want, fire me an email afterwards. We'll see what we can dig up. But that's, you know, something really to look into. Another point that I did sort of miss on this article. Yes. Any other questions, comments? Please.
Some people say that on Yom Tov, halacha, you should have meat. Is that...
So that's what we talked about here with the Rambam. How that boils down halacha lemaisa is actually a machlokes. I was thinking of having this on here again and omitted it for the sake of time. There appears to be a big discussion as to whether it's actually 100% required nowadays. The Magen Avraham, who is one of the main commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, actually contradicts himself from one place to the next. One time he says it's a halachic requirement to have nowadays. Another place he says now the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, like we saw in the Gemara, it's not a requirement. Meaning that's not exactly what the Gemara says directly. I'm not saying the Gemara supports that conclusion. I'm just saying, akin to what we saw in the Gemara, that there is no karban, and therefore this Ein Simcha Ella Bebasar does not necessarily apply anymore. But there are poskim that really follow both streams, both trains of thought here. Some that say it is not required halachically nowadays. Others that say absolutely it is. And that is one of the discussions in Rabbi Bleich's article as well. The continuation of that article deals with this specific halachic point within having to or having not to eat meat if one were to be a vegetarian. Even within the very vegetarian camps, who really, unfortunately, ignore a lot of what Rav Kook had to say about vegetarianism nowadays, from what I've seen a couple of articles which really sort of omit that fact, and say, oh, Rav Kook says that vegetarianism is such a moral ideal, and don't really talk about his opposition to implementing it as a moral ideal nowadays, which I think was why Rabbi Bleich is kind of strong, because that's something that really is out there. One of them suggested that he ate a token amount of meat just to show that we're not in the days of the Messiah yet, but he really would have been a vegetarian. You know, it's hard to know exactly how to go about that, but you know, certainly there is at least a shadow of a halachic requirement to eat meat on certain happy days, specifically Yamim Tovim, where there would be many poskim that would say that, yes, this is a halachic requirement. If someone was a vegetarian and there was, you know, an important reason for them not to be eating meat, again, we're not going to sit, you know, and force people at gunpoint to eat meat all of Yom Tov, every Yom Tov, but there may be a halachic issue there as well, yes.
When Rabbi Kook is talking about vegetarians for people, does he mean the whole world or Jews? Who's he talking about?
So that's a very good question. I mean, you have to see exactly what he's saying, but it seems that he's talking about society at large. He believes that we'll return to the pre-Noach, and really Adam before
the
Chait.
The entire world, regardless, not only the Jews, but everybody else.
Yes, he sees it to be a moral ideal. That's something that we would want the nations of the world to take from us. And that's sort of the way he portrays it, I believe. I'll have to check exactly his language, but you know, even if he would just say it was for the Jews, certainly he would feel that if it's a moral ideal, the non-Jews should be following it as well, and we should be showing them that.
That's another issue.
Right, but... Yeah. Anything else before we move on? Okay, so article number 2 for the day. This one's... you know, we like to call it Inyana Diyoma. You know, right now, as we give this year, there are doubtless many dozens of children circulating Thornhill and Toronto trick-or-treating. So this is something that's a little bit related. Man sells house and car to pay $600K to psychic charged in evil spirit scam. A 27-year-old woman is facing charges of witchcraft and fraud after allegedly bilking a man out of $600,000. Police in York Region, okay, so this is right here, said that about 4 years ago, a 67-year-old man met with a psychic using the name Ivana, who claimed she could rid him of evil spirits in his home. According to the victim, the woman told him that he had to sell his home and transfer the money to her account, where she would hold the money until the spirits were removed. I mean, it makes sense if the home is, you know, has evil spirits, you have to sell the home. I'm sure that really worked. He did, and then the suspect allegedly did not return the money, shockingly, and instead told the victim she needed $6,000 more, which she said she would burn in order to ward off the spirits. It's alleged that the victim then sold his car and used credit and other sources to pay for several additional demands for money. Police began to investigate the incident, reported as elder financial abuse in November. Samantha Stevenson, 27, of Toronto, also known as Ivana Lopez, has been charged with pretending to practice witchcraft, fraud over $5,000, and possession of property obtained by crime. as one of the commenters very smartly said in this article, you'd think that if she was already getting rid of the evil spirits from the house for $600,000, she'd also be able to magically disappear. But, you know, she didn't manage to disappear, and she has been charged with these different charges. Again, when it comes to a lot of these issues, there are some very, very clearly wrong things that are going on. You know, fraud, stealing, misleading people is very, very clearly prohibited by the Torah for everybody, and we don't really need to focus on that. But we do get to talk a little bit again about one of the more local issues to this case, which is witchcraft and magic. This will be a bit of a springboard discussion again about it, but it also really relates to this in terms of what would the Torah say about, A, if it were to be actual witchcraft that they're practicing, and B, which is our case, pretending to practice witchcraft. This is one of the charges that were laid against this woman, and it's something that the Torah actually does talk about quite a bit. Certainly within Tanakh, there are a number of stories relating to either black magic or witchcraft of some sorts, as well as in Shas, all over the place. Traditionally, you know, now is when the famous argument between the Rambam and pretty much everybody else comes up. The Rambam says, of course there's no such thing as magic, and everybody else says, of course there's such a thing as magic, and then that's how it's displayed. I tried to bring it forward in a bit of a different way. So there's three Torah sources here that I pulled up sort of for the discussion. One in Shemos, one in Vayikra, and one on the last page in Devarim. So source number one is Mechashefalos Chayeh, you shall not allow a sorceress to live. What that means, Lo Sechayeh, rather she shall be put to death. But, you know, there are various Mefarshim on that that sort of explain this as perhaps maybe even something akin to a witch hunt. You must seek them out, make sure they are not living. Real witches were something that were despised by the Torah, as we're going to see for a few reasons, possibly. But most relating to Avodah Zarah, which is why such a harsh punishment would be suggested for these people. But we will see, again, sort of another take on that. In Vayikra, lo sochalu al hadam, you shall not eat any meat with the blood in it. However, lo sina chashu velo seoninu, neither shall use enchantments nor practice sorcery. That's another one directed at Klal Yisrael. That is an Avera. And finally, lo yimatzei v'chala, do not be found within you ma'avir b'no uvito ba'esh, anyone who passes his son or his daughter through the fire, kosim kisamim, me'onein, nachesh, chashef, and various sort of magic-related, bless you, various sort of magic-related usages, I would say. If any, you know, this should not be something that is found amongst the Jewish people. Any of these, kosim kisamim, me'onein, nachesh, chashef, ma'avir, me'onein, all of these things are you know, sorcery and like related to Avodah Zarah as well, and these should be strongly avoided and are prohibited, in fact. We can say that directly. So, Rav Hirsch here actually takes a very interesting way to interpret the pasuk. I'm going to quote what he discusses in terms of the language of the word kishuf, mechashef, as well as mechashefa lo sechayeh. He tends to explain words based on how they sound in similar words, and he actually brings a number of words that are similar to kishuf. And here, one of them that he brings is kazav. The way we pronounce the word is similar, both pronunciations of both words. I'm not going to go into the entire science that he goes through, but a lot of related words, he says, is all about trickery. Kishuf seems to be focused on trickery, and we have here, you know, according to our way of understanding it, in the Rambam, which he's quoting from Hilchos Avodos Kochavim 11, Tesvav and Teszayin, which are 15 and 16. So he says he's going to follow the Rambam. It's saying, "Ve'eino ela shlita meduma b'seder ha'olam shel Hashem." It's only, you know, an assumed mastery. It's a deception, an assumed mastery of God's laws of nature. The reason why the English is more important is because both the English and the Hebrew are translated from an original German. So taking one over the other, or translating through the Hebrew, actually removes you a step from what Rav Hirsch said. So reading the English is just as accurate a translation, I mean, depending on the translators and a few other factors, but it's the same number of degrees removed from what he wrote. Is nothing but deception, nothing but an assumed mastery of God's laws of nature, would be rather a folly to be smiled at or a madness to be pitied than a crime to be punished. Were it not that it exercises such a deep demoralizing influence on the community. And he sort of touches on two points, and he really elaborates upon this in his commentary there. Again, sort of something that I left out in favor of space here, and I feel like I've been saying that a lot. Maybe I should expand to 6 pages next week. But what he is trying to say is, based on his understanding of the pasuk, kishuv is simply what we know as practicing magic. someone who is tricking other people in some way. You know, some of the very popular performers of this day and age are magicians. And, you know, there may even be concerns with going to a magic show halachically. Again, each individual question should be posed to a rabbi. But according to Rav Hirsch, what it talks about, that you shall not let a witch live, refers to someone who's simply tricking people. We're not even talking about someone who has any sort of supernatural power. No amazing things that they can do with again, some sort of special power, but rather they're just tricking people. And we know that they're working through some sort of trick. Nonetheless, even though we think, oh, maybe that's something to laugh at, or it's, you know, sad that people believe in it. But he says, no, it has such a deep demoralizing influence on the community. And what might that mean? When he says it's a deep demoralizing influence on the community. Anything?
Well, if you saw somebody do something and you say, gee, I can't do that. I mean, he's really got skills that I don't have, and I'm much lesser than the person who's doing this.
Okay, that could be one interpretation, saying that you'd feel worse because this person looks much better than other people. That's an interesting interpretation.
But it's not the right
one. I don't believe that that's what... correct. I don't believe that that's what Rav Hirsch intended from reading that, you know, general paragraph there.
Like he has got a God-given talents that no one else can do.
So that's sort of similar to, I think, what Linda was suggesting, but I don't believe that's the direction that he's going.
Yeah.
Direction that I believe he follows is one that the Rambam himself mentions in Mor Nevuchim and is fleshed out by a couple of other commentaries here who say that the purposes of these were usually to make people believe that you did have such powers. And even if people knew that you were maybe playing tricks, first of all, there were always going to be people that didn't know you were playing tricks. And not only that, but the purpose was to convince people that, yes, you had some sort of power, and that in itself was sort of demoralizing enough. It was supporting Avodah Zarah, and it was really, you know, showing others that, yeah, you know, I can do things, you know, that are more powerful than you. And you sort of, even now, when you watch magic shows, in a sense, I know that I've experienced this, you're like, that's crazy. That's like real magic. Like, you almost want to start believing in magic when you see some of these illusionists because they're so good at it. And when that was something that was being presented as power from non-godly beings or other gods, in a lot of cases, that's something that the Torah really doesn't want around. On the other hand, he wouldn't say that it's direct Avodah Zarah. He says technically it's not something that really would be worthy of death, but because of its influence and because of its impact, it can. I'm not going to say that this is exactly the same as our case, because it's not. But another consideration here is if you're conning people and if you're tricking people, that's also not something you want to go about. Never mind conning them out of their money, but even just in general, tricking people and you know, making them think one thing when another thing is happening is not such a great thing to be doing for a living altogether, especially when people would come to request personal advice from these people, you know, as we have Me'onei, Numnachei, Shumchashef, all these different types of magic and all these different types of prediction of the future and things like that. You are essentially taking plenty of vulnerable people and subjecting them to all this sort of trickery, oftentimes to really take their money away from them. And that's something that certainly you know, rings true from this article, and I think can also be a possible interpretation of why we are so opposed to witchcraft and witches, if in fact magic's not a real thing. Go ahead.
Does this include advertising? All Madison Avenue, I mean, that's...
Well, yeah, I mean, that there was a shiur actually Rabbi Greenberg gave on that last year, and, you know, talking about advertising and misrepresentation in general. And, you know, again, I'm not saying anybody who's a magician is a rasha, you know, the opposite. But there were many, many people who in the past were involved in you know, very negative endeavors in terms of conning people in one way or the other by using these sort of means. The problem is as follows. Rav Hirsch is very nice to say this. You know, before we get to the problems are really in source number 8. Let's go back one more step. There is a Gemara which discusses this exact pasuk. It says, Mechashef alos chayeh ha-mechashef. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin in source number 7 tells us the following, and this is with the Torah Tamima's note and interpretation. Ha-mechashef ha-oseh ma'aseh chayev, one who performs an action. What does performing an action mean? It means to do real magic, says, you know, this is the interpretation of the Gemara. If someone does real magic, chayev, they are liable for the death penalty, but not one who simply deceives the eyes. Okay, this is the Gemara's comment on what is a mechashefa that you should be putting to death, or a mechashef that you should be putting to death. This is one who does an action. Now, you know, obviously, you know, if you're doing sleight of hand and you're trying to trick people, you're doing an action, but that's not what the Gemara is referring to. The Gemara is talking about if you're actually doing some sort of black magic, again, manipulating forces to go against the laws of nature. And the Torah Tmimah notes something, again, very, very important, that is forgotten here. We think, therefore, what's the problem with being a witch? What's the problem with being, again, someone who's performing these magical acts? It's actually performing the magical act. So it would lead us to think that there's absolutely nothing wrong with simply deceiving people with a quick, you know, hand motion or something like that, which we call Ochei Zainayim. Says the Torah Tmimah, Rotzeh Lomar, Ezehu Mechashef Shechayev Misa, Huzeha Oseh Maaseh, which is the one that is liable for the death penalty. That's the one that actually uses, again, other, you know, mystical sources to perform some sort of magic. Aval Zulas Chiyuv Misa, Gam Ochei Zainayim Bichla Mechashefu. But outside of the death penalty, the person who's being Ochei Zainayim and tricking people in that way is also considered a Mechashef. She'al Zeh Ne'emar Lo Tenachashu V'lo Se'oneinu. And about this it says, neither shall use enchantments nor practice sorcery. And it is his opinion, the Torah Tmimah, Rabbi Baruch Epstein, was not that long ago, and he says, yes, Ochei Zainayim is still wrong, even if Mechashef, who is Oseh Ma'aseh, someone who's really doing black magic, even if that's sort of what's prohibited, but still doing little tricks is also a problem, just not necessarily liable for the death penalty, which would be, again, presumably related to Avodah Zarah. So that's sort of his take on things. There are people who specifically say the opposite. They say, well, being that almost everybody interprets this pasuk and these halachos to be referring to real magic, therefore there's nothing wrong with a little sleight of hand. You know, obviously there are differences, again, especially when you talk about the morals of this, in terms of conning people rather than presenting, you know, this person has such great hands and is a great illusionist, and they're able to make illusions. That's something a little bit different than perhaps someone pretending to be something that they're not and saying, I have magical powers, look, I can make fire appear out of thin air. But on the other hand, you know, there is something to be said to say it's not just someone who performs black magic, that even according to those people, like the Gemara's opinion, that that's what's, you know, liable for the death penalty, there still may be something wrong with other methods of magic, even if you do accept that. And this last part is a long, long discussion from Rav David Zvi Hoffman, who is really someone, you know, a really significant rationalist. He taught in various rabbinical seminaries in Germany at the time of Rav Hirsch and Rav Hildesheimer, you know, and in some ways was very accepted by the mainstream Orthodox community. In other ways, he joined forces with some more maskilish characters who weren't necessarily as accepted. But he has a parish on Chumash, and he actually makes a, you know, an excellent comment. Rashar, which is Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch, me'ameitz es da'ato shel Rambam, shehakishuf eino ela ramai, ha'ose atzmo kemisha mesugala asos ma'asim al tiviyim be'ezrasam shel ruchos v'shedim. He says he's really supporting and strengthening the Rambam's position that a sorcerer is only some sort of cheater who makes himself look as if he's performing supernatural acts with the help of spirits. Umitchazen, he makes it look kemi she'omnam kashur lekachos elyonim, as if he is, you know, somewhere, you know, tied in or in control of higher powers. And the truth is, this kind of surprised me. Rav Hirsch, you know, in addition to not being the Rambam's biggest fan from some of his other writings, also, I mean, it doesn't seem like the type of opinion he'd sort of follow necessarily in the psukim here, being that you have so much of the corpus of Chazal, as well as other places in Tanakh that really seem to be referring to dark magic and black magic and, you know, other types of magic that control some sort of powers, you know, in a way that God doesn't want people to be using them. Not that God, obviously if God wanted to stop that, he could, but he doesn't want people to use these powers which he sets in the world. And as he says, Bram, mutar lirot b'deyazu de'a shenidches hen b'tanach hen b'divrei Chazal. He says, you know, it is permitted to see within this an opinion that really has been pushed off by Tanakh and pushed off by Divrei Chazal, by what the rabbis and the sages have to say. Ki hinei miforashu b'mesechet Sanhedrin. It is very, very clear in the Gemara Sanhedrin, which we just read, ha-mechashef. What is a mechashef that is liable for the death penalty? What did we say? A real witch. Someone who does actions of sorcery. Okay? V'lo ha-ochei zeinayim, and not one who simply performs, you know, hands, you know, sleight of hand tricks, or, you know, again, in some way, illusions. V'od yoster tzarich litmo al Rambam. But, you know, it's even more bewildering. We even need to ask even further on the Rambam. Haposek b'ilchot avodah zara, and I would have loved to bring this, but there's not much more than what he quotes here that we really need to see in these two halachos. So if you look in, you know, Perek Yudalef, halacha tes vav tes zayin, the Rambam says, ha'ochei zinayim, if one, again, simply just does some sort of eye holding, which is literally what achiz zinayim means, again, where you sort of trick someone with movements and illusions, patur. Okay, they're not liable for the death penalty. Umiyad la'achar mikin, but immediately following that, who Kotevi writes, hadvarim ha'elu kulan divrei sheker hein. Says anybody that thinks that magic exists is completely crazy. Magic completely doesn't exist, and there is no way that magic exists, and that's the end of the story. So this doesn't make any sense. First he tells you that not real magic is not subject, and then he tells you that real magic doesn't exist. So, you know, this is really hard to reconcile within its own opinion. And he says, you have MS, and I'll tell you. Rak bedochak efshar yiyel lefaresh et kol haksuvim shebahem medubar bekishuv uve magiya v'chadome. It'd be very, very stretched and you know, to explain all of the different psukim that we have in Tanakh, which talk about these types of magic. If we actually believe that these are just, you know, some sort of trickery, falsehood, it would be very hard to explain very, very many parts of the Torah, Nevi'im, and Ksuvim. It says, let's not trick ourselves, pun intended. He says, you know what, I'm going to tell you that's not true. It's not the case. And again, this is not, you know, some mystical, close-minded, ancient, you know, person talking. Not that there aren't many great, you know, close-minded, mystical ancients, but this is someone, you know, really, you know, fairly recent, who's in general a big rationalist, and he says the following. He says, Akishu ve'apulos hamagios ha'acheros. Again, all sorts of different sorcery. Lo hayu kulan kazav. They are not all trickery. They're not all falsehood. Lefachos chelek meosehen yadu alodos kochos tistarim shafilu hayom amadalogila adayin. He says at least many of them, or at least some of them, a significant portion of them, knew about some sort of hidden forces that even today science has not yet, you know, explained to us fully and uncovered. Efshar shekoch mishicha v'chashmal. So he says, think of things like electricity, think of things like magnetism. Kochos shebishatam lo hayu yiduim, that at those times were not known. Shimshu liyot ehem emtsaim lemaasei kichuf. These were used to people who knew about them in some way as a form of magic. Meaning it wasn't a trickery where they were pretending to do something. They realized that if you hold this stone next to this stone, you can make this stone jump. Right? Imagine someone seeing some sort of magnetic trick across the table. See, look, I can make this move. And the magnet moves along with them. That's not sleight of hand. That was really magic for them. And it's not, and he's going to explain, it's not that, right? Shimshu liyodeyam emtsayim la'asei kishuf. Aval gam kochos acherim she'ad hayom lo nit baharu. But there will other, you know, there are other forces that even today we might still not know about. Shimshu levitzua pilot al tiviot lichora. These were what were used for sort of these supernatural occurrences and supernatural performances that these people used to make. It's not that they knew it in a scientific way, this is how this works, and therefore I can manipulate this using that. And they didn't use them, you know, sort of the way that we use them now. Oh, you want to turn on the light. Everybody knows that's not magic. But rather, they realized that there was something they could do that would affect something like this. And they used him in that way, and that was magic. And so Dewey says it may very well be that we will discover forces in the future that right now we don't understand and we think are magical. And we'll understand them at some future point in time. But magic does not necessarily imply, you know, something that we can't relate to. He says we can relate to a supernatural sort of magic in this way. By thinking, what must it have been for a person to have discovered some facet of electricity or some facet of magnetism or some facet of another power or force that we don't, you know, we can't quite explain yet, and to use it in a magical way, not in a scientific way, the way everybody knows, and still, you know, really trick people. And that was kishuf that sort of people talked about. God put these forces in the world, and people can use them in that way. And he says that would be real magic, not fake magic. Again, if we use it nowadays in a way that we trick people, that might be more like achizat einayim. But this is sort of a rationalistic take on believing in magic. So I thought that was interesting, and we'll finish up in a moment. Yes?
There's a movie that is the very premise of the entire movie, is that there's these two magicians that are performing at the time that electricity was being developed, and they're basically, their entire show is marketing electricity as magic. The Prestige.
Interesting, The Prestige, okay.
I was going to talk about the magicians at the time of Mitzrayim.
Yes, the Chartumim.
They really did things, but they also realized that, you know, they couldn't create the lice because they said it was too small. But they knew this has to be an act of God.
Yes, we're going to talk about that really in this last line that we have right over here. You're bang on. And let's just finish up. And he says, even less, you know, it would be even less wise to deny all of these historical sort of testimonies that we have, whether it be from the Torah, whether it be from the Gemaros. You know, you can try to reinterpret them as you wish, you know, Rambam and his camp, but you can't deny that there have been many, many descriptions of this. Rak mishum she'en anachnu mevinim osam, just because we don't understand how they work. He says, if it's just a matter of saying we don't know how it works, so therefore it can't exist, it must be some trick, you could apply that same logic, he says, lo aleinu, or really, you know, God forbid, to prophecy. Oh, prophecy can't possibly be real. We don't understand how God communicates with a person. Oh, miracles can't be real. Yetzias Mitzrayim can't be real. It must have been some sort of elaborate trick. He says, that's where this logic will take someone. It can really push someone in this direction because, well, we don't understand it, therefore it's not true. Even though the Torah is talking about magic, oh, well, we don't understand it, so it can't be true. He's saying this would be a logical extension of the argument made by the Rambam. Not that he's saying the Rambam believes that, chas v'shalom. Of course, the Rambam doesn't. But on the other hand, you know, he's saying this opens sort of a can of worms in that sense. And therefore, again, however the Rambam chooses to interpret these things that were going on in the Torah, yes, the Rambam believes in miracles. But the Rambam doesn't believe that, you know, other people have the way, you know, a way to manipulate natural forces to make something supernatural happen, however he wishes to interpret it. And again, this is why we said there's plenty of places in Tanakh that are very hard to explain. And, you know, the Rambam also explains Ma'amari Chazal differently. You know, this is not just local to exactly magic. There may be other things about Chedim and Malachim and things like that. As well, but not that we're discussing now, but in terms of just tricking people and even pretending to practice witchcraft, yes, witchcraft may be prohibited, but pretending to practice witchcraft has all these other things associated with it that are not that great either, as we saw in the first couple of sources. Again, the demoralizing influence it has, the relationship to Avodah Zarah, the fact that you're still tricking people, that's something that's really not that, you know, not that good to be practicing, certainly, and I believe the Torah would be strongly, we know for a fact the Torah is strongly opposed to actions like these, but even perhaps from a witchcraft perspective, even though we know that this person doesn't actually have any special powers, there may be that, but certainly this you know, comment of Rav David Zvi Hoffman here, I felt was very valuable to share with, you know, the audience here tonight.
So I have two questions. So first of all, is there any problem with practicing magic or being a magician?
You have to ask a personal shayla based on the case.
The other question I have is, so is there any criticism, or would there be if the Torah had been given to that point, of Yaakov and what he did with the sheep and that?
That's a very good question. Trickery in general, it's very hard to really know how to approach a lot of these stories, especially in Sefer Bereishis that deal with trickery. Yaakov is not the only one with Lavan. There he's really re-tricking Lavan. And even another story that, you know, sort of bothers us is Yaakov and Esav, coming up exactly very, very soon. There was actually a fascinating presentation at Limud this past week by one of the participants was Marvin Huberman. And they had a case in Canadian law as to whether Esav or Yaakov should be the ones to really receive the Bechora legally after the fact. So that sounded like it was very entertaining, actually, just was discussing it with him. But there are quite a few cases where people trick other people and say, for Bereishis, Shechem and Dinah comes to mind, something which I touch on, not the morality of it, but that story in the front page article of Toronto Torah coming out this week. These are quite problematic stories, some of them, and depending on the circumstances, sometimes the Torah is willing to say, well, you know, you're playing a game with other people who are taking part in this game, like in the case of Lavan.
What are you talking about, the rods and...
so yeah. the rods and the sheep, you know, and the tricks that Yaakov may have played on Lavan, you know, many will say that that's because, you know, they're sort of engaging in games with each other.
So the difference between the other examples where Yaakov dresses up as Esav or is that, so there is tricking, but here with the rods, so he's sort of trying to manipulate the forces of nature, no, with the sheep and the
yes, rod. Again, depending right. on how you interpret right. that, yes, whether it's genetics, right. whether it's magic, whether it's, you know, God performing right. some sort of miracle. Again, I don't want to keep anybody past the time, so you're all welcome to go as we continue this conversation. But you know, again, if you want to hear what we're talking about, you're welcome to stay. But the shiur, as far as I'm concerned, is over. Again, I don't want to keep anybody. But yes, when it comes to doing that, I mean, if there's godly intervention, and there are a number of midrashim that talk about in each of these cases, God saying that this is okay, or God's after the fact approval, or God's before the fact approval that justifies it in some ways. But you know, if someone were to do that nowadays, you know, unjustly, certainly would be something to talk about.
But people still practice black magic, like especially in the South. Now, you know, you don't hear about it here in Canada, but in the U.S., you certainly hear about it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. I don't know
the
how that...
Exactly.
So what happened is that right. the Catholicism in Haiti contains so much black magic that it
yeah.
really is like a half and half.
Right. Yeah. You know, and when I was working down there, I
we're in the southern states.
In the southern states, yeah. And even someone in Chicago too. You know, there are groups of people that definitely believe in it and definitely practice it.
Thank
what
you.
Do you mean
Thank
practice
you.
It? What would they do?
Oh, put curses on people.
But the thing is that Judaism has curses also.
Well,
womanization
so what's different
of witchcraft? Because
how come
it's only
Mashifalot?
All the Mefarshim had that question. It seems that was more common.
I don't know, because I'm not familiar
that's a simple
with
answer.
Jewish curses.
Okay.
You know, I'm